I am privileged and honored to introduce our final speaker for the afternoon. Dr. Tiarone Lodog is the director of the Fellowship of Integrative Medicine at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, a program that was originally founded by Andrew Weil. He's the chair of the U.S. Pharmacopeia of Dietary Supplements and Botanicals Expert Committee. Dr. Lodog has an extensive career studying natural medicine. He has practiced a wide range of practices, including midwifery, massage. She's an accomplished and respected and sought after for her extensive knowledge as an herbalist. Her past leadership roles have included the president of the American Herbalist Guild. She was a member of President Bill Clinton's White House Commission on Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And she was on the advisory council for the National Institute for Health, National Center on Complementary and Alternative Medicine. She is a recipient of multiple national awards. She is an author, and she has greater than 30 publications and books to her name. I am pleased and honored to count her as a friend, and would like to welcome her here to close this afternoon.
Well, I'm like Daphne, and I actually won't be able to stand behind the podium and wriggle. I got the wriggles. Somebody said that this morning, something about the wriggles. I got the wriggles myself. So we'll get the mic, and I'm going to pace around. When Mary asked me if I would come and participate, obviously the first thing I said was I would do anything for you, because Larry Rosen is just truly a gifted healer and somebody that's very compassionate and dedicated to this cause. Then David came on and talked to me, and I said, I do anything for you too. So there's a... Okay. It'll be just perfect. We'll make it work. Thank you so much. And you just heard so many things. I was struck by a few things, though. One was I was definitely struck by the fact that if my grandparents, and I would even say my great-grandparents, who I actually knew, were here, they would say that, gosh, what's all this all about? Didn't y'all know all this? How much millions of dollars have you spent to try to figure that out? Really? Gosh. Bond church. Farm people, rural people, born at home, my kids born at home, organic, that's when poor people ate organic, I was in the Girl Scouts 40 years ago. Why? Because it was the only way to go camping, It's like you're told enough Girl Scouts with you, you go camping. I was in the 4-H because I had a horse, A lot of what we've been talking about today is the way people have always lived, except now we can take it up a notch because we're not dying so much of acute infections, and we have better childbirth abilities to be able to bring children into the world healthy. Now we're struggling with different issues, but they're kind of all the same. I'd like to start by just saying I know I'm influenced by the fact that I took care of pregnant women for a very long time. And babies. And we didn't talk a whole lot about this baby inside of that first environment. The first environment that you and I ever lived in was within our mother's womb. How do you want the world to be for a pregnant woman? What kind of environment would feel right to take a woman who is with child? I think if you answered that question right there, you could lay out a vision for what we would like to work towards. they're doing a lot looking at food origin of adult disease, you know. What happens when you're inside your mother's womb and how that affects you as an adult. How it affects your genetic expression. Does it increase the risk for diabetes? Does it increase the risk for obesity? Will some cancers be linked to this? And I would say, well, of course. Long time ago, I had epilepsy. Long time ago, I went out to the Navajo Reservation. I worked for the Indian Health Service for a number of years. I went out to be a healer. And, of course, the first thing you do is you go to a diagnostician, one of the hand trainers, and they diagnose you. Well, I go out there and drive forever to get out there, and I go into the Hogan and ready for the diagnosis and to talk to him to see which healer I was going to go to. And he wanted to know where my mother was. I said, excuse me? He's like, where's your mother? I'm like, long way away. He said, oh, well, I can't help you. Come back with your mother. I was like, okay. I went outside with the man who had taken me there, and I said, I don't really understand why I have to bring my mother. I mean, like, I can give them all the information he needs. And he said, I don't know. Once in Navajo, most of the illness, you have to go back to the mother. You have to ask the mother what she dreamed when she was pregnant. You have to ask her what she ate when she was pregnant. You have to ask her what the birth was like. You have to ask her the first time she knew that a miracle had happened within her. I was like, wow, okay. I couldn't even be diagnosed. I couldn't even be helped without my mother to be there with me. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment, because now we're looking at this whole fetal origin of disease. And here you have people that have lived close to the earth but don't know anything in that kind of way about genetic expression and inheritance and these things, saying to me, where's your mother? I can't help you without her. So this is critically important. Pregnant women, what we feel, what we think, what we dream, I do think it influences our children. I think they get a clue of what the world is like by being inside of us. And what we are feeling inside of us, I believe they are experiencing it. We share that with them. All of you who've been in here who've had a child, remember that moment when you first felt them move. That moment when you were intimately aware that there was life surging within you. It's not a fetus. It's life. Well, talk to a pregnant woman about the fetus in her. Talk about her baby. I'm fascinated with the language that we use about fetal development. Life. Human development. And that womb is a very sacred place. It disturbs me that the Environmental Working Group and the American Red Cross could take the umbilical cord blood of 10 babies fresh from the womb and 200 tentacles to be isolated from that blood. And the fact that that doesn't disturb people on a really deep level disturbs me on a really deep level. I heard a lady arguing on CNN. We can analyze anything. We can find parts per trillion. It doesn't mean anything. And I'm like, wow, it doesn't? Amazing to me. Pregnancy is a critical time in a woman's life, and it's a very critical time in setting the stage for this young life. I want to talk about what it means to be born in the USA. I'm going to just use a little example for a moment of birth. Of what I would consider the absolute medicalization of life. You know, we know that a healthy society, basically, given what we know about maternity and maternal issues and fetal health and baby's health, about 5 to 10% of births will end up in a cesarean section. That's about normal, that's about healthy, 5 to 10%. When we look at in 1965, when we first started measuring cesareans in the United States, it was about 4.5%. We're right about there, about 5%. 1 in 3 women now give birth by cesarean section. 1 in 3. I can tell you that at those levels, at 31, almost 32%, we are at a place where we're doing harm. There's no question. We are doing harm. And we're doing harm in some of the most vulnerable situations we have. Why are we having more C-sections? Well, we read all kinds of things, you know. It's like, well, you know, women are getting heavier. Obese women, there's more complications, you know, so we got to live in our C-section. And let me tell you, once you're a C-section, it doesn't matter what the evidence shows, it's going to be really hard for those 3 hour vaginal birth. I mean, we do not give enough informed consent, so women know their choices about a vaginal birth after C-section, but a lot of times, this is not, it's not going to happen. Medical legal? It's not going to happen. So women, once they're at the cesarean section, will continue to have C-section. I would argue, as a midwife, that a lot of this is because we don't have patience. We don't have patience. There is not somebody constantly with her, working with her, feeding her, nourishing her, moving her, getting her up, walking her around. Worst thing you can do is be strapped to a bed with a continuous fetal monitor on you. You can't move. You can't get up. You're going to be in more pain, more discomfort. You're going to need more anesthesia. And I guarantee you, you're buying yourself a cesarean. Are C-sections bad? No, not for those situations where they're called for. But what are we finding out about C-sections? Well, we're finding out that actually those children don't do as well. So why are we doing so many early inductions? Why are we doing early inductions? You know, taking a woman who is not 41 weeks, 40, 41 weeks, when her cervix is not ready, and you start inducing labor for all kinds of reasons. Oh, for all kinds of reasons. Well, I want my husband to be able to do that. I'm like, okay, what does that mean exactly? Well, I thought if we did it on the Thursday, because he was going to go out of town on Sunday, so if we went ahead and started on Thursday, and it would work for me, really, because I thought somebody that I could have come over to the house, and then it worked. If we did it on Thursday, then I was kind of coming, and I'm just sitting there going, oh, my God. You know, in California, your for-profit hospitals have C-section rates that are just, like, astronomical. Here in California, when you compare them to non-profits and for-profits in the same location, and you compare the population, your for-profits are doing so many more C-sections. Why? Not because they pay a lot more money, but because, man, babies take time, they take up labor rooms, you gotta have, you could be a day in there, a day and a half, really easy if you can schedule all your C-sections and births between 7 and 2. You clear out all the rooms, you gotta order your organizer staff, how many nursing people you need, I mean, it's just so much more easier. It's such a pain, you know? When I was midwife and going to people's house, I mean, sometimes they go 38 hours. 39 hours. My friend used to, because he got drugged with me all the time over to all these people's houses. He's been to more births than most people will ever see. And it's like, you know, and it's like, how long is it going to be now? You know? And I'm like, you know, when the baby's ready, the baby will come. Early induction, part of the problem for me is that they almost always lead to this cascade of events. Once you start the induction, pretty much by default, we're going to put you on continuous fetal monitoring. We're going to end up a lot of times rupturing your bag. We're going to do all kinds of things to get things going. There's going to be more forceps. There's going to be more stuff, and we get a lot more C-sections. What I'm saying is that I think that this medicalization of the birth process is a very interesting piece of where we are right now. And you can't talk about whole children if you're not talking about how they come into the world. This is some of the stuff with C-section. I want you to look at all these kinds of references. You know, it's like, it's not, these are not alternative journals. This isn't, you know, Explore Alternative Therapies and Complementary Medicine. I'm talking about, you know, the National Academy of Science, the Journal of Pediatrics, the Journals of Epidemiology. What we know is that children that are born by C-section have more respiratory disease, they have more allergies, they have more cow's milk allergies, they're at higher risk for asthma. And we definitely know now that it sets the stage for celiac. So, and why are we seeing more of these things? Well, I would argue that not only are we seeing more environmental pressures and more pollution, but I would also say that we've been seeing this increasing number of cesarean sections since the 70s and 80s when it really began to explode. And you can also parallel that with celiac, and you can parallel it with asthma, and a lot of the other things we're seeing. The other downside of this is that after a cesarean section, it's often much more difficult to get mom and baby to have successful breastfeeding. So it's not just the birth, but it's also the breastfeeding. It's just harder to get everything working, especially in that first 2 hours after the baby is born. What do we think some of these problems are with these allergies? Well, interesting. When you are born vaginally, I got all this very grotesque, but when you are born vaginally, you basically swallow and ingest your mother's vaginal fluid. So you get her microbiota, that you get her vaginal flora. In many ways, it's almost like a fingerprint. I mean, your flora, if you were born vaginally, was identical to your mother's. You share her whole microbiome inside of her. When you're born through a mother's belly, by cesarean, basically you're colonized by skin bacteria. That's what you colonize. So this is why we think that this whole microbiome, this difference between having her healthy sort of flora, vaginal flora, and having skin flora inoculate you. We believe that's partly what's setting it up. Now everybody's going, we can use probiotics, we can use prebiotics, we can do all kinds of things in the last month of pregnancy that might help ensure. And I'm saying, yes, I think we should examine all of those things. But I'd say it doesn't really get at the main issue that probably 20% of cesarean sections that we're doing in this country are unnecessary. When you have cesarean, I'm just using it as an example so I can tie a few things together. You end up with more kids coming in with ear infections because moms don't know that they've got a child's mouth allergies. They have more respiratory problems, they have more asthma. They end up on more antibiotics, more medications, more hospitalizations, more missed school, mom misses work more. I mean, you know the whole thing. And the baby's not breastfeeding. Oftentimes, I've done a lot of work with lactation consultants who are worth their weight in gold, helping us with moms with breastfeeding. Many of these mothers just have more problems. And again, breastfeeding matters. Breastfeeding matters. 390,000 children, roughly a year, die of rotavirus in the world. One of the best ways we protect from rotavirus is through your breast milk. You know, cow milk is great for baby cows. Breast milk's great for babies. You know, but we went to breastfeeding for 4 to 6 months. How long do women have off in this country before they usually have to go back to work? How long? 6 weeks. 6 weeks, that's off. You've got a good job. You've got a good job. 6 weeks. I was a resident when our daughter was born, when Sarah was born. I was a resident. So here I am in family practice, and you'd think everybody's going to help me with breastfeeding and all kinds of stuff, you know. And it was, one attendant told me I had picked a very inconvenient time to get pregnant and have a baby. That was one, because I wanted to go to feeds and pump. So inconvenient, because I needed to go and pump breast milk to pump for my child. It's pretty funny though on my surgical rotation because I'm standing there and, you know, you're there 36 hours, surgeons take 24 hours, and I'm pumping and everything. I'm standing there at Loveless Hospital with Earl Badger, and we're doing a thyroidectomy. And, you know, I'm in family practice, so basically I'm there just to hold the retractor, right? And then get sent on all the questions, right? So I'm standing there holding it, and he's kind of a curmudgeonly old guy. I love him. He's curmudgeonly. He's standing there, he's got his glasses on, he's doing his thyroidectomy. And I said, Dr. Badger. Yeah. I said, I got a question. He said, what is it? Okay. So I just want to know about the sterile field. So if breast milk comes from the inside to the outside of the gown during the surgery, did I break the sterile field? Yeah, I'll be scooping squats right here on the front of my gown. And he started laughing with me. Look at me. I put the stuff down and walked down these huge spots. And it was funny, because later on he said, I actually never had that happen. I wasn't quite sure the answer. So, breastfeeding is critical. It's critical. And we definitely know that if you breastfeed your children for 4 to 6 months, it reduces their risk of infections, but I would tell you it helps reduce the risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer in the mother. It may help with obesity, diabetes, and other things that we don't quite know, but this is all the statistics, but I'll tell you, as a nursing mother, there's nothing quite like sitting there giving life to yourself. That's all my children ate for almost 6 months. That's all they lived on was what came from me. My milk, my breast sustained them, gave them life. Now think about that. Think about how empowering that is. Think about what connection that is between a mother and a child. I think 6 weeks is not long enough for moms to have all. For, it's like children are our future. Children are most important. Children, we have to do all these things for children. Why are pediatricians and teachers paid the least, and why do we give 6 weeks off after a bit mother had a baby? If we really value, why is that our policy? Interesting question, aren't they? I just want to say that I think there's another way. I want to just say I think there's another way. And I hope all of you sort of take this with you when you leave today. Midwife-led care. This is from the Cochrane database. This is the Cochrane group. This is the folks that are supposed to be the international reviewers that, give us the best data that's available. And this is what they say. The Cochrane database. Midwife-led care. Women who have midwives as their guides, their partners, during their prenatal and birth, significantly more likely to have a spontaneous vaginal birth, initiate breastfeeding, and feel in control. Period. That's all you really needed to read. Compared to OB managed care, midwives did it better. That's just the bottom line. Midwives did it better. Less likely to have regional anesthesia, less likely to have forceps or instrumentation, less likely to have an episiotomy. And this is what they concluded. All women should be offered midwife-led models of care, and women should be encouraged to ask for this option. Okay? So it's one way that I would just say that for us, if we're looking about bringing healthy children into the world, it's helping moms have a good experience, to have a good experience so that when she gives birth to the baby, that the baby comes into the world in the most gentle way possible. My kids were born at home, but what was very powerful was when our daughter was born at home, she came very fast. Very fast. Our son, he'd been off and he came home and said his stomach hurt. He wanted to know if he could lay on my bed. I said, sure. Midwife dropped by. They were doing construction on the house. I was mopping the floor. And my midwife stopped in. She says, how are you doing? I said, I'm fine. I said, just trying to get this, all this desk and all this construction work, She said, how about you just let me check you? I'm like, I don't want to be checked. What are you doing? I'm out on the floor, Barb. Father Pepper, she's here from Midwife. She sits down for me. She said, could you make me a cup of tea? Well, I was totally annoyed at that point because I'm trying to mop the floor. She wants a cup of tea. She sees that I'm busy. And I find that, I'm out of here. She waits, 45 minutes later, as she's finishing her tea, my water's great. How do they know? I never know. Those midwives. So I went into the room, and we were going to call people. My best friends were going to come over. Folks were going to come. Nobody was there. Basically, you, the midwife, and my friend. And I looked into my son's eyes, who was almost 12. I laid on my side. He laid in front of me. Think about this. Think of his age. He laid right here in front of me. Our eyes were maybe 8 or 10 inches apart. And he said, what do I do? And I said, you'll know, honey. You'll know. And I labored 10 minutes, 15 minutes, not long. He laid right there with me and never took his eyes off of me. And I had this surreal moment as I was looking into his eyes, was that I was giving birth to a child as I was looking into my child's eyes. It was staggeringly beautiful. And the midwife, Barb, when Sarah came into the world, the first thing she said was, her ears look fine, because we had been told she's probably a Down baby. And Barb thought she looked healthy. And she came in, and then she said to Makote, would you like to cut full? And here's that little boy laying there staring deep into my eyes, never blinked, never took his eyes off me. And he said, "Would you be okay if I did that?" I said, "Yes." And he just kind of looked, and then he just slid down the bed. He went over, and she put her hands around his, and he cut the cord, and then he held his baby sister. And he sat at the edge of the bed, and I watched my two children in that moment. And the reason I share that is because I think that's the way birth is intended to be. I think that's the way birth was intended to be. You know, my son has been at the bedside now to watch a birth, and he's been at the bedside of somebody who's died. Do you know how few people today in this world actually see their siblings born or sit at the bedside of somebody who died? A garden is about the cycle of life, but we have disconnected us on so many levels from just birth and death, the birth and death, that people don't, they're not in the awareness of it anymore. But midwives are the way to go. Gentle births are the way to bring children into the world. And I love what I think Cynthia said earlier, and she said to NICU, how could we make it more like a womb and less like a spaceship? It struck me. Why would you want to put a newborn baby fresh from the womb in a place that's lit all day in a plastic bin? I remember on NCAM we had to argue over the evidence for infant massage. I was sitting there going, well, Tiffany Fields did a bunch of this work, and it's like, I remember we were sitting there arguing about whether we were going to fund another study. Well, those studies had a lot of flaws. I mean, and again, and again, and I'm like, why are we studying this? Who needs evidence to suggest that a little bitty baby should be touched? That's insanity. That's insanity. Babies need to be touched. They need to be put on the skin. They need to be nursed. I didn't even go home with my mother. I didn't know that my mother was diagnosed with thyroid cancer when she was pregnant with me. I never knew that until my grandmother told me just not even that long ago. And so she's telling my daughter and I that when my mother gave birth, she laid me. She came home with me. I was a fresh-born baby. And she said, it was cold. I was going to the end of November. And she said, I just laid you. I got naked. And I put the naked on top of me with a little diaper. And I just snuggled you in. And she said, and you tried to nurse. Because I was reading, looking instinctively for that breath. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, told me, she said, and my breath ate to feed you. Clara said, you know, Grandma, great Grandma, it's Grandma. That's why you and Mom are so close. It's kind of like monkeys, how they imprint on, you know, things. We've kind of imprinted. My grandma looked at her and she said, like monkeys? Like, yeah, they're in there. See how powerful that is, though? And that imprinting? Don't think for a moment that she didn't imprint on me, because I was closer to my grandmother than just about anybody in the world, and I do believe I imprinted on her, and she on me. Breastfeeding, that human touch, so powerful at the beginning of our life. Birthing centers. Why would you not have hospital rooms where you labored and delivered in the same room that looked like a bedroom, that had a place for people to sleep and relax and move? Why would we not have that? Why don't all hospitals have that? All of them should be like that. It's a no-brainer. Please don't tell me we need to study it. Okay? Mind, body, breathwork and yoga. Imagine that. Higher birth weight, shorter labor, fewer medical interventions, and reduction in mom's stress and anxiety. And if mom has less stress and less anxiety, so will the baby. So will the baby. If mom feels more self-assured, so will the baby. All right, let's leave this for a moment. We talked about antibiotics. We talked about farm. A farm girl. And I know we overprescribe antibiotics, but I want to be really clear that the problem with antibiotic resistance in this country is not primarily by people prescribing antibiotics. It is because we give it to animals. you give them more antibiotics than you could even imagine. 60,000 people die in this country alone every year because we don't have antibiotics for all these resistant infections that are developing. But I want you to look at that high code. Where is most of the antibiotics being used? Non-therapeutic life use in livestock. 71%. 71%. We use 15. Soap, 10%. Everybody goes, soap. I'm like, all these antibacterial kind of soap. And then therapy for livestock. So this is a huge issue. But that's what you have to do with animals when you treat them like that. You gotta load them up with antibiotics because you gotta treat them prophylactically because they all get sick. They all get sick. Now, the European Union years ago moved to only limit antibiotic use, only therapeutic use, and only four of them can be used. Only four antibiotics. In this country, we've just refused to make those kinds of steps. I'm telling you, if you want to have an impact as healthcare providers, one of the first things you've got to do is educate yourself and your patients about if they're going to eat meat. Please don't buy meat that continues to perpetuate the use of all these antibiotics. And a deeper thing like that is, would you want to eat that? Is that what would nourish you? Is that what nourishes you? No. No. I remember we were driving to Dallas, Texas, and my dad, he loved his steak as much as any man would. He says, my Lord, driving through here, he said, it's enough to make me be a vegetarian. Why? 10 miles away, you could smell the people. 10 miles away, you could start to get that odor. And we drove by, and even he was just like, this is awful. He grew up on a farm. He didn't keep them like that. They were all out in the pasture. They all come running up to the truck when you dropped off the hay. They were just big old cows, you know. They lived happy, happy lives for a lot of years. Until their life was over, and they were shot, and they were pulled up and gutted and cleaned, and that's where you had it. You had your beef right to draw all dinner long. But it wasn't like this. That's more like what you want to eat. And it doesn't require all those antibiotics. I must say also that today it has disturbed me on some deep level. I mean, I know I'm a medical doctor. I know. And I read research and I read all these kinds of things. But I must say that, you know, sometimes when I'm writing a review paper and I gotta go do all the research and I'm reading about, you know, mice, rats, dogs, goats, monkeys, apes, you know, we stress them, we expose them, we burn them, we sacrifice them so that we can see what drugs and exposures and things do to them so that we can extrapolate it to us. There is a part of me that I can't hardly take that. Just reading it sometimes hurts me. It's like, I don't know how you can talk about a world in which we're all connected and we still think that's okay. It's not. I'm not saying there's not a place for some of it, but good Lord, how many times have you got to do the same studies over and over and over and over and over and over again? How much evidence is ever enough? You know, what I've come to find is that I appreciate science so much. I'm the daughter of a science teacher. But I don't want to be a slave to it. I do not want to be a slave to it. And I do not want to have to harm other living beings to give me information that my common sense already tells me I should know. You can look for these kinds of signs for doing away with antibiotics. These are helpful. This is something you can just let patients know. You know, you can just tell them to look for these kinds of things and which ones are for antibiotics free. So like the USDA organic on meat prohibited, animals raised on a diet without antibiotics, only used to treat sick, and no feed additives, non-therapeutic antibiotics, only used to treat sick animals. So these are ways that people can become more informed so that they don't have to support this. And any physician who does not take the time to describe this in their office or nurse is really doing a disservice, because we cannot keep talking about antibiotic resistance when 71% of the antibiotics that are being used in this country are for non-therapeutic uses in animals. Okay? It's a big area that we can have an impact on. And I just thought this was interesting because I'd like to propose this as somebody who does a lot with herbs. I thought this was the coolest thing I'd ever seen from the Institute of Medicine. So this is the Institute of Medicine that wrote this. And just think about it for a moment. These are scientists. Think of what they said here. Our focus on conquering infectious disease may reflects the more ambitious yet more pragmatic aims. Little consideration has been given to the notion that perhaps we could learn to live with a pathogen instead of being so insistent on getting rid of it. Interesting. Although the recognition of AIDS in 1981 has inspired the most intense biomedical research program in history, the incidence of disease is only increasing. Would this trend reverse this? Instead of focusing exclusively on ways to conquer HIV, we were to give equal weight to developing therapeutic measures that nurtured the immune system that HIV arose. Wow. I thought that was very cool. I thought that was very cool because in herbal medicine, we have these whole classes of herbs called adaptogens and things that boost up the immune system and make you more resilient. And all the things that were being talked about with, you know, nourishing and good foods and things like that, those are all the things that nurture your immune system as well. You know, it's like, there's just this, you know, nature is so rich in so many things, not just the foods that we can eat, but also the plants and the medicines that have been in relation with us for thousands and thousands of years. You know, my body and my grandmother's body and her great-grandmother's body never saw, you know, sadness. But they have had a long relation with most of the compounds that are found in these plants because people have used them for medicine since ancient times. Our bodies are more programmed and more, these plants have a more ancient relationship with us than most of the modern drugs today. Things like elderberry. You know, elderberries now have been shown in the same models that we use to study other things with H1N1 to be very effective at blocking the H1N1 virus. Imagine if we talk to people about using those, because we've already seen Tamiflu resistance. I mean, look at Eleuthero and Ginseng and Shiganga. These are the great adaptogens that we know can be very helpful in protecting us from stress. Andrographis, which definitely in multiple clinical trials has shown it reduces flu, and then astragalus, which is one of our deep immune tonics that you can actually just eat like food, make it in soup. And the last thing I want to mention is stress. Because somebody talked about the elephant in the room. That's a big part of the elephant in the room. Think about what stress does to our physiology. And think about children. Think about children's reaction to stress. The smallest people with oftentimes the least ability to be able to say, quit being like that to me. I was heart sick the other day. We were leaving to come here yesterday, and my husband and I got in the car, and I said, I just felt so sad today. And he said, what's the matter? And I said, well, saw on the news that this boy killed himself. And my husband right away, he said, oh yeah, the boy with the somebody had filmed him having sex. And I said, my heart just aches. I told him, I said, my heart just aches. I just, like, as a mother, as a person on the planet, as his sister, it made me so sad that people would do that to him, and that also he felt so ashamed and embarrassed that he took his own life. That saddened me deeply. Stress is a huge thing. I don't think we've begun to really help children figure out exactly how to cope. Playing was the way that most of us coped with a lot of it when we were kids. I mean, we were. You came home from school, you took off your clothes, your mother said, get out of the house, and you went and played till dinner. Then you came home, and if it was light outside, you could go back out until it was kind of time to go to bed, until it was getting dark. And that was it every night. Now, kids have like 4 hours of homework. And what is that? What is that? Our daughter, when she was in school, she's in the fourth grade. And she's coming home every night. She's like falling asleep doing her homework. And she's in the fourth grade. I thought, no, I'm going to go over and talk to the teacher. And I ring, you know, and I was like, is she not paying attention? Is she talking? Is she, you know, why isn't she getting her work done? Oh, no, she's a very good student. She's very quiet. And I'm like, you know, you're talking about Chantel, Sarah Lodad. No, it's very quiet today. I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, I'm confused. Why is she got so much homework to do? I'm like, is she not seeing the board? Do you think she's got a problem? Do you need to get some extra help? No. Cooper was just so flabbergasted. Do you understand what I'm talking about? She goes, oh, no. She goes, off. You know, she's in the fourth grade. One more year, and then she's off to middle school. I was like, yeah? She goes, they've got to start getting used to doing a lot of homework. I was like, wow, I said, really? I said, she does a lot of homework. I said, sometimes like 3 hours. And she said, well, I mean, you know, that's maybe a little more, but they need to be doing at least 2 to 3 hours of homework. And I said to her, well, I'm just not going to do that. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm just not going to ever do that. I'm going to give her like 30 minutes, and then what she doesn't finish, she just won't finish, you know. She said, well, she'll get zero. I said, okay. She said, well, no, I mean, she'll get zero. And I said, okay. I said, last time I looked, I was in college, they're looking at fourth grade pencils. I'm not too worried. I told her, as I walked out the door, if you have a job that you work 8 hours a day in and you got to go home every night 3 hours and do more work, you should quit. Because I'm not going to have my child do that. You want. What I'm telling you is that, well, that's Kathy. But it's true. It's like you can't have kids sit all day and then come home and do homework all night. It's crazy. That's the prescription for Adderall and Ritalin. These are millions of prescriptions, and these are the age groups. I want you to look at 5 to 9-year-olds. Millions of prescriptions. I don't know. I'm the mother of a son with ADHD. So I've lived with this for a long time. In our own household, our own life. I think it's complicated. There's all kinds of studies now showing that when you measure some of these organophosphates and other kinds of pesticides in the urine of children with ADHD, they have much higher levels than others. I believe that could be possible with Makote, except, you know, we were organic and we were vegetarians and, I mean, we just didn't have that kind of lifestyle. No sugar. And he used to joke with people about his mother when I put him on his elimination diet. I basically just eliminated all food for a couple days, and I gave him a little rice. And a couple days later, I gave him a little rice with the rice. And a couple days later, I gave him a little about 2 weeks later, I said, I think he's seen calmer. I do. I think he's seen calmer. And he's got tears in his eyes. And goes, I'm so hungry. I'm like, oh, my God. And then he loves to tell the story. He's like, that was my mom. She was convinced it was something in the food, you know. And it was like, I'm thinking, we don't get to eat anything fun. How could it be anything in the food? So I don't know that that's it. We went home. He was on Ritalin. We went back up to South Dakota, where my family was. And it was in the summer, and I had been told that he should not go on a drug holiday. Now remember, this is a long time ago. I'm told he's 28. And he was in fourth grade. And we went up, and they were having a big barbecue. And I had him come in so I could give him his medicine. He was just on Ritalin, instant release Ritalin, and he was dosed twice a day. And my uncle came in, who was quite old. He saw me giving a prescription pill, because he saw the bottle. And he came over and he said, what's wrong with the boy? So I started to explain that he had this problem sitting still, he had this problem with focusing, and you can clearly see that this man had no clue what I was talking about. And he looked at me again and he said, well, what's wrong with him? And I said, well, you know, he has this thing called attention deficit hyperactive disorder. Yeah, and then as I was saying it, I was just like, I don't want to talk to my uncle about this, you know. And I said, he's fine. Yeah, he has a hard time concentrating and getting his work done at school and stuff like that. But he's doing great, you know. Went back to the women who were cooking. I looked out through the kitchen window and I see my son over there with my uncle. And I'm thinking, oh, great. So they're over there for a long time over by the trail. Just as fast as he can. Just running, you know how they do, you know, slams the door, you know, runs in, he's like, Mom! I said, what? Shut it off. Take a deep breath. Calm down. You know what? I said, what, baby? You know what? You know why our last name is Wardog? I was like, as a matter of fact, I do. And he's like, I said, why do you think our last name is Wardog? He goes, well, silly, that's why I am the way I am. I said,
what do you think that means to you, honey? And he says, like, low dog means like dogs low to the ground, like coyotes, you know, because that's who we were. Because all of the men in our family were scouts. All of them had to go out and they had to do the hunting and they had to look for all the bad guys and they had to protect everybody. So they were always out looking around where everything was, and that's why our name's Low Dog. And because I'm a low dog, I'm supposed to be a scout. Unless he said, I'm not supposed to be a pipe maker. And he ran out the door. And I felt so bad. Because I loved him so much. And of all the things I tried to do with his diet and with his exercise and giving him the medicine and trying to do all this stuff at school and getting an occupational therapist and doing all this stuff, that old man with a sixth grade education gave him the one thing I didn't know how to do, which was, you are okay. You were born to be this way. In our tribe, you had a valued position. In our tribe, your ability to just be distracted by things probably kept us alive. You were born to be a scout. You were not born to be a pipe maker. I took him out of school. And I homeschooled him. And he went to college. And he's at Berkeley, and he's doing fine. But I realized that we have become more and more what we narrow for our children of what is normal. This is normal, that's not normal. And we will medicate you to be normal. You're a little depressed? Here's a pill. You're a little anxious? I got another pill. Used to be shyness when I was a child, not social anxiety. I'm not saying that these things aren't real or that medications aren't sometimes necessary, but what I'm telling you is all the things you've heard today by people so much smarter than me, you gotta eat right, but not be obsessive. You gotta play, because playing is where creativity is born, where it happens. You need to let children be children. Don't schedule their days away. Resist people who tell you, you got to be thinking in fourth grade what they need to be doing for college. Resist all of those kinds of things and trust in yourself that you know what is right for your children, and help parents trust in their own selves that they know what's right for their children. Last thought is, Emerson said once that there are voices that we hear in solitude that grow faint and inaudible as we enter into the world. That's why you go out in nature. That's why you go out to be alone. It's sometimes it's the only time you can hear your own voice. Your own voice, not the voice of your mother or your father or your boss or your husband or your wife or anybody else, but just your own true voice. And you come back in, and the email starts, and the text messaging starts, and the phone starts, and the television starts, and everything starts, and you can't remember your voice. Unplug. Unplug. Go walk in nature and find your voice again. In our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next 7 generations. We must. We must. When I think about things, I don't want to just think about my children. I want to think about their children and their children. I am the daughter of Vivian. She's the daughter of Josephine. Who's the daughter of Goldie, who's the daughter of Annie Virginia, who's the daughter of Elizabeth, who's the daughter of Mary, who's the daughter of Elizabeth. I have worked hard to learn all the women's names in my family and their stories and who they are, because I believe this is all about relationships. It is all relational. In Lakota, there are 2 words called Mfakiel Yasi. It means we are all related.
Whatever befalls the earth befalls the sons and daughters of the earth. For man did not weave the web of life. He is merely a strand in it. Whatever he does to the web, he does to himself. You've heard about complex theories, system theories, ecology. You've heard about neurochemistry and neurotoxicity. You've heard about nutrition. You've heard about all of it. And I would tell you, that was said hundreds of years ago before we came up with all of those things, and it's as true today as it ever was. Those who don't look to the past are bound to repeat the mistakes of the past. Stay connected. Keep yourself and your children close to the ground. Keep your food close to nature, as natural as it comes. Never, ever, ever miss the opportunity to tell people that you love them. Ever. Never leave the house without telling your children that you love them. 28 years old, my son, visiting us from church, he had to leave at 4:30 in the morning to catch a plane. I went in, I kissed him goodbye, told him I loved him. Later on the phone, my daughter said, the coach has said that he loves that you still come in, Mom, and kiss us goodbye before you leave on a plane. Never, ever miss an opportunity to let the people know that you love them. Fight for what you can. Be at peace with the things that you can't fight. Some things are going to be your battle, some things are not. But I will tell you this. The one thing that will make a difference to you in your life is when you're an old, old person, you want to look back on your life and you want the people in your life that mattered to say that you mattered. I wish you all a wonderful day, and I thank you for having the opportunity to just share a few thoughts with you. I hope you give a huge round of applause for all the people who put all the work on for this conference. I hope you go and do forth good things. Bless you.
Mary and David said, you have to talk. Look at them. They're sitting there. They said, oh, this just, you did the wrap up. He tried to tell me, and I said, I tried to get out of it. Thank you. Thank you. I think you touched all of us and me. So many stories. I think each of us could tell in this room that you've all poured. Each of our presenters today, I just, what an honor, what a privilege. And I look forward to finding ways to continue to remember our interconnectedness and what we value most. Life in this planet. And we will figure out ways. And I was talking about the online evaluations right now. Sounds really so out of context. And yes, there will be online evaluations, and there are still book sales. But most important, I certainly feel, and I will use this term here, blessed to be with all of you today and to have just had the privilege of being re-inspired to go forward into the complexities of this life and to try to make a difference and to do it meaningfully. And by being at a conference like this where you leave energized and inspired rather than drained and wondering, you know, How am I going to go home and face all that I have to do? It's a gift. This day has been a real gift. Certainly to me. I hope to all of you, and I hope we'll stay in touch.